He could hear his jaw muscles creaking. The snap hiss of release echoed throughout the hall. A dozen taut strings twanged. The bolts were too fast to follow, dark afterimages that blurred the air, and then a dozen narrow black shapes rebounded off nothing right before his face and fell clattering to the floor, scattered in an arc like dead birds at his feet. Locke laughed, a high and genuine sound of pleasure. For one brief moment he would have kissed the falconer if the bondsmage had stood before him. "Please," he said, "I thought you'd listen to the stories." "Just establishing your bona fides," said Kappa Barsavi. "Your Majesty." The last word was sneered. Locke had at least expected a certain wariness following the blunting of the crossbow attack, but Barsavi stepped forward without apparent fear.
"I'm pleased that you've answered my summons," Locke replied. "The blood of my daughter is the only thing that summoned me," said Barsavi.
"Dwell on it, if you must," said Locke, praying silently as he extemporized.
"Nazca, gods, please forgive me."
"Were you any gentler when you took this city for yourself 22 years ago? Is that what you think you're doing?"
Barsavi stopped and stared at him. They were about 40 feet apart.
"Taking my city from me?" "I summoned you to discuss the matter of Camor," said Locke, "to settle it to our mutual satisfaction."
The falconer hadn't interrupted him yet. He presumed he was doing well.
"The satisfaction," said Barsavi, "will not be mutual."
He raised his left hand, and one man stepped from the crowd. Locke peered at this man carefully. He seemed to be an older fellow, slight and balding, and he wasn't wearing armor. Very curious. He also appeared to be shivering.
"Do as we discussed, Aemon," said the Kappa. "I'll hold true to my bargain, truer than any I've ever made."
The unarmored man began to walk forward, slowly, hesitantly, staring at Locke with obvious fear. But still he kept coming, straight toward Locke, while 100 armed men and women waited behind him, doing nothing.
"I pray," said Locke, with a bantering tone, "that man isn't contemplating what I suspect." "We'll all see what his business is soon enough," said the Kappa. "I cannot be cut or pierced," said Locke, "and this man will die at my touch." "So it's been said," replied the Kappa.
Aemon continued to move forward. He was 30 feet from Locke, then 20.
"Aemon," said Locke, "you are being ill-used. Stop now."
Gods, he thought, don't do what I think you're going to do. Don't make the falconer kill you. Aemon continued to shamble forward. His jowls were quivering, and he was breathing in short, sharp gasps. His hands were out before him, shaking like a man about to reach into a fire. "Crooked warden," Locke thought, "please let him be scared. Please let him stop. Falconer, falconer, please put a fright into him. Do anything else but kill him." A river of sweat ran down his spine. He bent his head slightly and fixed Aemon with a stare. 10 feet now lay between them.
"Aemon," he said,
striving for a casual tone and not entirely succeeding,
"you have been warned. You are in mortal peril."
"Oh, yeah?" said the man, his voice quavering. "Yeah, that I know."
And then he closed the distance between them, and he reached out for Locke's right arm with both of his hands. Fuck, thought Locke, and although he knew deep down that it would be the falconer killing the man and not himself, he flinched back from Aemon's touch. Aemon's eyes lit up. He gasped, and then, to Locke's horror, he leapt forward and grabbed Locke's arm with both of his hands, like a scavenger bird clutching at a long-delayed meal.
"Ah!"
he cried, and for one brief second Locke thought something terrible was happening to him. But no, Imon still lived, and he had a very firm grip. "Double fuck," Locke mumbled, bringing up his left fist to clout the poor fellow, but he was off balance, and Imon had him at a disadvantage. The slender man gave Locke a shove backward, screaming once again, "Ah!" A cry of absolute triumph. Locke puzzled over it as he fell flat on his ass. And then there were booted feet slapping the stones behind Imon, and dark shapes rushing around him to grab at Locke. In the dancing light cast by 24 moving torches, Locke found himself hauled back up to his feet, pinned by strong hands that clutched at his arms and his shoulders and his neck. Kappa Barsavi pushed through his eager crowd of men and women, forced Imon more gently to the side, and stood face to face with Locke, his fat, ruddy features alight with anticipation.
"Well, Your Majesty," he said, "I'll bet you're one confused son of a bitch right about now."
And then Barsavi's people were laughing, cheering. And then the copper's ham-hock fist planted itself in Locke's stomach, and the air rushed out of his lungs, and black pain exploded in his chest. And then he knew just how deeply in the shit he truly was. 4.
"Yes, I'll bet you're pretty goddamned curious at this point," said Barsavi, strutting back and forth in front of Locke,
who remained pinioned by 6 men, any one of them half again his size.
"And so am I. Let's throw that hood back, boys."
Rough hands yanked at Locke's hood and mantle, and the kappa stared coldly at him, running one hand up and down his beards.
"Grey, grey, grey. You look like you belong on a stage," he laughed. "And such a skinny fellow, too. What a weak little man we've caught ourselves tonight. The Grey King, sovereign of fog and shadows and precious little else."
The kappa backhanded him, grinning. The stinging pain had just registered when he did it again from the other direction. Locke's head lolled. He was grabbed from behind by his hair and made to look the kappa right in the face. Locke's thoughts whirled. Had the kappa's men somehow located the falconer? Had they distracted him? Was the kappa mad enough to actually kill a bondsmage if he had the chance?
"Oh, we know you can't be cut," continued Barsavi. "And we know you can't be pierced, more's the pity. But bruised? It's a curious thing about the spells of a bondsmage. They're so damn specific, aren't they?"
And then he punched Locke in the stomach again, to a murmur of widespread amusement. Locke's knees buckled beneath him, and his attendants hoisted him again, holding him upright as bolts of pain radiated from his abdomen.
"One of your men," said Barsavi, "strolled into my floating grave this very morning."
A little chill crept down Locke's spine.
"Seems I'm not the only one you pissed off when you sent my Nazca back to me the way you did," said Barsavi, leering. "Seems that some of your men didn't sign on with your merry little crew for that sort of god's damn desecration. So your man and I, we had ourselves a talk, and we fixed a price, and then he told me all sorts of fascinating things about that spell of yours, and that story about you being able to kill men with a touch. Oh, he told me it was bullshit."
"Sewn up," said a little voice at the back of Locke's head that most certainly was not the falconer. "Sewn up, sewn up." Of course the falconer hadn't been distracted or taken by any of Barsavi's men. Neat as a god's damned hanging.
"But I was only willing to trust the fellow so far," Barsavi said. "So I made a deal with Imon, who I'm sure you don't recognize. Imon is dying. He has the cold consumption, the tumors in his stomach and his back, the sort no physica can cure. He's got maybe 2 months
maybe less." The copper clapped Aemon on the back as proudly as if the skinny man were his own flesh and blood. "So I said, why don't you step up and grab the filthy little bastard, Aemon? If you really can kill with a touch, well, you'll go quick and easy. And if he can't?" Barsavi grinned, his red cheeks wrinkling grotesquely. "Well, then."
"A 1,000 full crowns," said Aemon, giggling.
"For starters," added Barsavi, "a promise I intend to keep, a promise I intend to expand. I told Aemon he'd die in his own villa, with gems and silks and half a dozen ladies of his choice from the Gilded Lilies to keep him company. I will invent pleasures for him. He'll die like a fucking duke, because tonight I name him the bravest man in Camor." There was a general roar of approval. Men and women applauded, and fists banged on armor and shields.
"Quite the opposite," Barsavi whispered, "of a sneaking, cowardly piece of shit who would murder my only daughter, who wouldn't even do it with his own hands, who'd let some fucking hireling work a twisted magic on her, a poisoner."
Barsavi spat in Locke's face. The warm spittle trickled down his cheek.
"Your man told me, of course, that your bondsmage had set his spell and left your services last night. That you were so very confident you didn't want to keep paying him. Well, I, for one, applaud your sense of economy."
Barsavi gestured to Andres and Pachero. Grim-faced, the two men stepped forward. They slipped their optics off and put them in vest pockets, an ominous gesture conducted in unconscious unison. Locke opened his mouth to say something, and then the realization of exactly how sewn up he was struck him cold. He could proclaim his true identity, have the kappa tear off his false moustache and rub away the wrinkles, spill the entire story, but what would it gain him? He would never be believed. He'd already displayed a bondsmage's protection. If he confessed to being Locke Lamora, the 100 men and women here would be after Jean and Bug and the Sansas next. If he was going to save them, he had to play the Grey King until the kappa was finished with him, and then he would pray for a quick and easy death. Let Locke Lamora just vanish one night, let his friends slip away to whatever better fate awaited them. Blinking back hot tears, he summoned up a grin, looked at the two Barsavi sons, and said,
"By all means, you fucking curs! Let's see if you can do any better than your father."
Andres and Pachero knew how to strike a man with the intent to kill, but just now they had no such intent. They bruised his ribs, knuckle-punched his arms, kicked his thighs, slapped his head from side to side, and punched him in the neck until every breath was a chore. At last Andres had him hoisted back up and took hold of his chin so that the two of them were looking eye to eye.
"By the way," said Andres, "this is from Locke Lamora."
Andres balanced Locke's chin on one finger and walloped him with his other hand. White-hot pain shot through Locke's neck, and in the red-tinted darkness around him he saw stars. He spat blood, coughed, and licked his sore, swollen lips.
"Now," said Barsavi, "I'll have a father's justice for Nazca's death."
He clapped his hands three times. Behind him there was an audible noise of men cursing and heavy footfalls banging against the stone steps. Through the door came 8 more men, carrying a large wooden cask, a cask the size of the one Nazca Barsavi had been returned to her father in, the funeral cask. The crowd around Barsavi and his sons parted eagerly to let the cask haulers through. They set it on the ground beside the kappa, and inside it Locke heard the slosh of liquid.
"Oh, 13 gods," he thought.
"Can't be cut, can't be pierced," said the kappa, as though he were musing out loud. "But you can certainly be bruised, and you certainly need to breathe."
2 of the kappa's men popped the lid on the cask open, and Locke was dragged over to it. The eye-watering stench of horse urine spilled out into the air, and he gagged, sobbing.
"Look at the Grey King cry," whispered Barsavi. "Look at the Grey King sob, a sight I will treasure to the last hour of my dying day."
His voice rose.
"Did Nazca sob? Did my daughter cry as you gave her her death? Somehow I don't think so."
The copper was shouting now.
"Take a last look! He gets what Nazca got. He dies as she died, but by my hand."
Barsavi seized Locke by the hair and tilted his face toward the barrel. For one brief, irrational moment, Locke was grateful that there was nothing in his stomach to throw up. The dry retching still brought spasms of pain to his much-abused stomach muscles.
"With one small touch," said the copper,
actually gulping back sobs of exhilaration.
"With one small touch, you son of a bitch! No poison for you. No quick way out before I put you in. You get to taste it the whole time, all the while as you drown in it."
And then he hefted Locke by the mantle, grunting. His men joined in, and together they hoisted him up over the rim. And then down he plunged, face first, down into thick, lukewarm filth that blotted out the noise of the world around him, down into darkness that burned his eyes and his cuts and swallowed him whole. 5. Barsavi's men slammed the lid back onto the barrel. Several of them hammered it down with mallets and axe butts until it was cinched tight. The copper gave the top of the barrel a thump with his fist and smiled broadly. Tears were still running down his cheeks.
"Somehow I don't think the poor fucker did as well as he hoped with our negotiations."
The men and women around him whooped and hollered, arms in the air, torches waving and casting wild shadows on the walls.
"Take this bastard and send him out to sea," said the copper, gesturing toward the waterfall.
A dozen pairs of eager hands grabbed at the barrel. Laughing and joking, a crowd of the copper's people hoisted it and carried it over to the northwestern corner of the echo hole, where water poured in from the ceiling and vanished into blackness through a fissure about 8 feet wide.
"One," said the leader, "two,"
and on the cusp of "three," they flung the barrel down into darkness. It struck water somewhere beneath them with a splash. Then they threw up their arms and began cheering once again.
"Tonight," cried Barsavi, "Duke Nicovante sleeps safe in his bed, locked away in his glass tower. Tonight the Grey King sleeps in piss, in a tomb that I have made for him. Tonight is my night. Who rules Camor?" "Barsavi," came the response from every throat in the echo hole,
reverberating around the alien-set stones of the structure, and the kappa was surrounded by a sea of noise, laughter, applause.
"Tonight," he yelled, "send messengers to every corner of my domains. Send runners to the last mistake. Send runners to catch fire. Wake the cauldron and the narrows and the dregs and all the snare. Tonight I throw open my doors. The right people of Camor will come to the floating grave as my guests. Tonight we'll have such a revel that the honest folk will bar their doors, that the yellow jackets will cringe in their barracks, that the gods themselves will look down and cry, 'What is that fucking racket?' Barsavi, Barsavi, Barsavi," his people chanted. "Tonight," he said at last, "we will celebrate. Tonight Camor has seen the last of kings."
Interlude. The Half-Crown War. 1. As time went by, Locke and the other gentleman bastards were occasionally set free to roam at leisure, dressed in ordinary clothing. Locke and Jean were getting on near 12. The Sansas were visibly slightly older.
It was more difficult to keep them cooped up beneath the house of Perelandro all the time, when they weren't sitting the steps or away on Father Chain's apprenticeships. Slowly but steadily, Chains was sending his boys out to be initiated in all the great temples of the other 11 Therin gods. One of them would enter a temple under a false name, sped along by whatever strings Chains could pull and whatever palms he could slip coins into. Once there, the young gentleman bastard would inevitably please his superiors with his scribing, his theological knowledge, his discipline, and his sincerity. Advancement came quickly, as fast as it could be had. Soon the newcomer would receive training in what was called interior ritual, the phrases and activities that priests only shared among themselves and their initiates. They were not quite secrets, these things. To any priest of a Therin order, the thought of someone being audacious enough to offend the gods by falsely seeking initiation was utterly alien. Even those who knew of the slightly heretical idea of the 13th, and even the minority who actually believed in him, failed to imagine that anyone would want to do what Chains and his boys were doing. Invariably, after several months of excellent accomplishments, each sterling young initiate would die in a sudden accident. Carlo favored drowning, for he could hold his breath a very long time, and he enjoyed swimming underwater. Galdo preferred to simply disappear, preferably during a storm or some other dramatic event. Locke constructed elaborate little mummeries that took weeks to plan. On one occasion he vanished from the Order of Nara, plague mistress, lady of ubiquitous maladies, by leaving his initiate's robe, torn apart and splashed with rabbit's blood, wrapped around his copywork and a few letters in an alley behind the temple. Thus enlightened, each boy would return and teach the others of what he had seen and heard.
"The point," said Chains, "is not to make you all candidates for the High Conclave of the 12, but to allow you to throw on whatever robes and masks are required, and pass as a priest for any short period of need. When you're a priest, people tend to see the robe rather than the man."
But there was no apprenticeship underway at the moment. Jean was drilling at the House of Glass Roses, and the other boys waited for him on the southern edge of the shifting market, on a crumbling stone pier at the end of a short alley. It was a warm spring day, breezy and fresh, with the sky half occluded by crescents of grey and white clouds sweeping in from the northwest, heralding storms. Locke and Carlo and Galdo were watching the results of a collision between a chicken seller's boat and a transporter of cats. Several cages had flown open when the small boats cracked against one another, and now agitated merchants were stepping warily back and forth as the battle between birds and felines progressed. A few chickens had escaped into the water and were flapping uselessly in little circles, squawking, for nature had conspired to make them even worse at swimming than they were at flying.
"Well," said a voice behind them, "have a look at this. These little wasters seem very likely."
Locke and the Sansas turned around as one to see a half-dozen boys and girls their own age standing behind them, spread out across the alley. They were dressed much as the gentleman bastards were, in unassuming clothes of common cut. Their apparent leader had a thick, dark mane of curly black hair, pulled behind him and tied with a black silk ribbon. Quite a mark of distinction for an urchin.
"Are you friends of the friends, lads? Are you the right sort of people?"
The leader of the newcomers stood with his hands on his hips. Behind him, a short girl made several hand gestures used for common identification by Kappa Barsavi's subjects.
"We are friends of the friends," said Locke. "The rightest sort of right," added Galdo, making the appropriate counter-gestures. "Good lads. We're the seconds to the full crowns in the Narrows. Call ourselves half-crowns. What's your allegiance?"
"Gentlemen bastards," said Locke. "Temple district."
"Who are you seconds to?" "We're not seconds to anyone," said Galdo. "It's just the gentlemen bastards, one and all."
"Savvy," said the leader of the half-crowns, with a friendly grin. "I'm Tesso Valanti. This is my crew. We're here to take your coin,
unless you want to kneel and give us your preference. Locke scowled. Preference, in the parlance of the right people, meant that the gentleman bastards would proclaim the half-crowns the better, tougher gang, make way for them on the street and tolerate whatever abuse the half-crowns saw fit to heap upon them. "I'm Locke Lamora," said Locke as he rose slowly to his feet, "and accepting the kappa, the gentleman bastards bend the knee to nobody."
"Really?"
Tesso feigned shock. "Even with 6-on-3? It's soft talk, if knows your answer."
"You must not hear very well," said Carlo, as he and his brother stood up in unison. "He said you get our preference when you pick the peas out of our shit and suck on them for dinner."
"Now that was uncalled for," said Tesso. "So I'm going to make some noise with your skulls."
Even before he'd finished speaking, the half-crowns were moving forward, and it was 6-on-3 at the end of the pier. Locke was the smallest child involved, even counting the girls, and while he went into the melee with his little fists swinging, he caught mostly air and was quickly knocked down. One older girl sat on his back, while another kicked alley grit into his face. The first boy to reach for Carlo got a knee in the groin and went down moaning. Right behind him came Tesso, with a hard right that sent Carlo backward. Galdo tackled Tesso around the waist, howling, and they hit the ground, scrabbling for leverage. Soft talk meant no weapons, and no blows that could kill or cripple. But just about anything else was on the table. The Sanzas were capable brawlers, but even if Locke had been able to hold up his end of the fight, the numbers would have told against them. In the end, after a few minutes of wrestling and swearing and kicking, the three gentleman bastards were dumped in the middle of the alley, dusty and battered.
"Right, lads. Preferences, is it? Let's hear 'em."
"Go fold yourself in half," said Locke, "and lick your arse."
"Oh, that's the wrong answer, short wit," said Tesso.
And while one of his boys pinned Locke's arms, the leader of the half-crowns patted Locke down for coins.
"Nothing. Well then, sweetmeats, we'll be looking for you again tomorrow, and the next day, and the next. Until you bend the knee, we'll watch you and we'll make your lives miserable. Mark my words, Locke Lamora."
The half-crowns strolled off, laughing, a few nursing bruises and sprains, but not nearly as many as they'd inflicted. The Sanzas arose groaning and helped Locke to his feet. Warily they limped back to the house of Perelandro together and slipped into the glass burrow through a drainage culvert equipped with a secret door.
"You're not going to believe what happened,"
said Locke as he and the Sanzas entered the dining room. Chains sat at the witchwood table, peering down at a collection of parchments, carefully scribing on one with a fine-cut quill. Forging customs papers was a sort of hobby, one he practiced the way some men kept gardens or bred hounds. He had a leather portfolio full of them, and he occasionally made good silver selling them.
Said Chains. "You got your asses walloped by a pack of half-crowns."
"How did you know?"
"Stopped by the last mistake last night. Heard about it from the full crowns. Told me their seconds might be sweeping the neighborhoods, looking for other juvies to push around."
"Why didn't you tell us?"
"I figured if you were being adequately cautious, they'd never be able to get the better of you. Looks like your attention was somewhere else."
"They said they wanted our preferences."
"Yeah," said Chains. "It's a juvie game. Most of the seconds don't get to pull real jobs just yet, so they train themselves up by pushing other seconds around. You should be proud of yourselves. You finally got noticed. Now you've got a little war until one of you cries mercy. Soft talk only, mind you."
"So," Locke said slowly, "what should we do?"
Chains reached over and grabbed Locke's fist, then mimed swinging it into Carlo's jaw.
"Repeat as necessary," said Chains, "until your problems are spitting up teeth."
"We tried that, and they jumped us while Jean was away, and you know I'm not much good at that sort of thing."
Sure I do. So next time, make sure you've got Jean with you, and use that devious little brain of yours.
Chains began melting a cylinder of sealing wax over a small candle. But I don't want to see anything too elaborate, Locke. Don't pull the watch or the temples or the Duke's army or anyone else into it. Try and make it look like you're just the pack of ordinary sneak thieves I tell everyone you are.
Oh, great. Locke folded his arms while Carlo and Galdo washed one another's bruised faces with wet cloths. So it's just another bloody test.
What a clever boy, muttered Chains, pouring liquid wax into a tiny silver vessel.
Of course it is. And I'll personally be very upset if those little shits aren't begging and pleading to give you their preference before Midsummer.
2. The next day, Locke and the Sansa brothers sat on the very same pier at the very same time. All over the shifting market, merchants were hauling down canvas tarps and furling canopies, for the rains that had drenched the city all night and half the morning were long gone.
"I must be seeing things," came the voice of Tesso Valanti, "because I can't imagine that you shitwits would really be sitting there right where we beat the trouser gravy out of you just yesterday."
"Why not?" said Locke. "Since we're closer to our turf than yours, and you're going to be using your balls for tonsils in about 2 minutes."
The three gentlemen bastards arose. Facing them were the same half-dozen half-crowns, with eager smiles on their faces.
"I see you're none better at sums than you were when we left you," said Tesso, cracking his knuckles. "Funny you should say that," said Locke, "since the sums have changed."
He pointed past the half-crowns. Tesso warily shifted his head to look behind him, but when he saw Jean Tannen standing in the alley behind his gang, he laughed.
"Still in our favor, I'd say."
He strolled toward Jean, who simply looked at him with a bland smile on his round face.
"What's this? A fat red bastard. I can see your glass eyes in your vest pocket. What do you think you're doing, fatty?"
"My name's Jean Tannen, and I'm the ambush."
Long months of training with Don Maranzala had left Jean looking little different than when he'd first begun, but Locke and the Sansas knew that a sort of alchemy had taken place beneath his soft exterior. Tesso stepped within his reach, grinning, and Jean's arms lashed out like the brass pistons in a Ferrari water engine. Tesso reeled backward, arms and legs wobbling like a marionette caught in a high wind. His head bowed forward, then he simply collapsed in a heap, his eyes rolling back in their sockets. A minor sort of hell broke loose in the alley. Three half-crown boys charged Locke and the Sansas. The two girls approached Jean warily. One of them tried to dash a handful of alley gravel in his face. He sidestepped, caught her arm, and swung her easily into one of the alley's stone walls. One of Don Maranzala's lessons, let walls and streets do the work for you when you fight with empty hands. As she bounced backward, Jean clotheslined her with a swift hook from his right arm and sent her face first to the gravel.
"It's not polite to hit girls," said her companion, circling him.
"It's even less polite to hit my friends," said Jean.
She replied by pivoting on her left heel and snapping a swift kick at his throat. He recognized the art called chasson, a sort of foot boxing imported from Tal Verar. He deflected the kick with the palm of his right hand, and she whirled into a second, using the momentum from her first to send her left leg whirling up and around. But Jean was moving past it before she struck. Her thigh, rather than her foot, slapped into his side, and he snaked his left arm around it. While she flailed for balance, he let her have a vicious kidney punch, and then he hooked her right leg out from beneath her, sending her to the gravel on her back, where she lay writhing in pain.
"Ladies," said Jean, "you must accept my deepest apologies."
Locke, as usual, was getting the worst of his encounter, until Jean grabbed his opponent by the shoulder and spun him around. Jean wrapped his heavy arms around the boy's waist and planted a headbutt in the boy's solar plexus. No sooner did the half-crown gasp in pain than Jean straightened up, cracking the boy's chin against the back of his head. The boy fell backward, dazed, and at that point the issue was decided. Carlo and Galdo had been evenly matched with their opponents when Jean suddenly loomed before them, with Locke at his side, doing his best to look dangerous. The half-crowns scrambled back and put their hands in the air.
"Well, Tesso," said Locke, when the curly-haired boy arose a few minutes later, bloody-nosed and wobbly. "Will you be giving over your preference now, or shall I let Jean beat on you some more?"
"I admit it was well done,"
said Tesso as his gang limped into a semicircle behind him.
"But I'd call us even at 1-1. You'll see us again soon."
3. So the battle went, as the days lengthened and spring turned into summer. Chains excused the boys from sitting the steps with him after the first hour of the afternoon, and they began roaming the north of Camor, hunting half-crowns with vigour. Tesso responded by unleashing the full strength of his little band. The full crowns were the largest real gang in Camor, and their seconds had a comparable pool of recruits, some of them fresh from Shades Hill. Even with the weight of numbers, however, the prowess of Jean Tannen was hard to answer, and so the nature of the battle changed. The full crowns split into smaller groups, attempting to isolate and ambush the gentleman bastards when they weren't together. For the most part, Locke kept his gang close at hand, but sometimes individual errands were unavoidable. Locke was beaten fairly badly on several occasions. He came to Jean one afternoon nursing a split lip and a pair of bruised shins.
"Look," he said, "it's been a few days since we had any piece of Tesso, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to lurk just south of the market tomorrow and look like I'm up to something. You're going to hide a long way off, 200 or 300 yards maybe, somewhere they can't possibly spot you."
"I'll never get to you in time," said Jean.
"The point isn't to get to me before I get beaten," said Locke. "The point is, when you do get there, you pound the crap out of him. You beat him so hard they'll hear the screaming in Talisham. Smack him around like you've never smacked him before."
"With pleasure," said Jean.
"But it won't happen. They'll only run away when they see me coming, as always. The one thing I can't do is keep up with them on foot."
"Just you leave that to me," said Locke, "and fetch your sewing kit. There's something I need you to do for me."
4. So it was that Locke Lamora lurked in an alley on an overcast day, very near to the place where the whole affair with the half-crowns had started. The shifting market was doing a brisk business, as folk attempted to get their shopping done before the sky started pouring down rain. Out there somewhere, watching Locke with comfortable anonymity from a little cockle-shell boat, was Jean Tannen. Locke only had to lurk conspicuously for half an hour before Tesso found him.
"Lamora," he said, "I thought you'd know better by now. I don't see any of your friends in the neighbourhood."
"Tesso, hello,"
Locke yawned.
"I think today's the day you'll be giving over your preference to me." "In a pig's fucking eye," said the older boy. "You know I don't even need help to knock you flat. What I think I'm going to do is take your clothes when I'm done and throw them in a canal. That'll be right humorous. Hell, the longer you put off bending the knee, the more fun I can have with you."
He advanced confidently to the attack, knowing that Locke had never once so much as kept up with him in a fight. Locke met him head on, shaking the left sleeve of his coat strangely. That sleeve was actually 5 feet longer than usual, courtesy of Jean Tannen's alterations. Locke had kept it cleverly folded against his side to conceal its true nature as Tesso approached. Although Locke had few gifts as a fighter, he could be startlingly fast, and the cuff of his sleeve had a small lead weight sewn into it to aid him in casting it. He flung it forth, wrapping it around Tesso's chest beneath the taller boy's arms. The lead weight carried it around as it stretched taut, and Locke caught it in his left hand.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
Tesso huffed. He clouted Locke just above his right eye. Locke flinched, but ignored the pain. He slipped the extended sleeve into a loop of cloth that hung out of his coat's left pocket, folded it back over itself, and pulled another cord just below it. The network of knotted cords that Jean had sewn inside his coat's lining cinched tight. Now the boys were chest to chest, and nothing short of a knife could free Tesso from the loop of thick cloth that tied them together. Locke wrapped his arms around Tesso's abdomen for good measure, and then wrapped his spindly legs around Tesso's legs, just above the taller boy's knees. Tesso shoved and slapped at Locke, struggling to part the two of them. Failing, he began punching Locke in the teeth and on the top of his head, heavy blows that left Locke seeing flashes of light.
"What the hell is this, Lamora?"
Tesso grunted with the effort of supporting Locke's weight in addition to his own. Finally, as Locke had hoped and expected, he threw himself forward. Locke landed on his back in the gravel with Tesso atop him. The air burst out of Locke's lungs, and the whole world seemed to shudder.
"This is ridiculous! You can't fight me, and now you can't run! Give up, Lamora!"
Locke spit blood into Tesso's face.
"I don't have to fight you, and I don't have to run!" he grinned wildly. "I just have to keep you here, until Jean gets back!"
Tesso gasped and looked around. Out on the shifting market, one small cockleshell boat was heading straight toward them. The plump shape of Jean Tannen was clearly visible within it, hauling rapidly on the oars.
"Oh, shit! You little bastard! Let me go! Let me go! Let me go!"
Tesso punctuated this with a series of punches. Soon enough, Locke was bleeding from his nose, his lips, his ears, and somewhere under his hair. Tesso was pounding him but good, yet he continued to cling madly to the older boy. His head was whirling with a combination of pain and triumph. Locke actually started laughing, high and gleeful, and perhaps a little bit mad.
"I don't have to fight or run," he cackled. "I changed the rules of the game. I just have to keep you here, asshole. Here until Jean gets back." "Gods damn it,"
Tesso hissed, and he redoubled his assault on Locke, punching and spitting and biting.
"Keep hitting," Locke sputtered. "You just keep hitting. I can take it all day. You just keep hitting me until Jean gets back."
Part 3. Revelation. Nature never deceives us. It is always we who deceive ourselves. Jean-Jacques Rousseau from Émile ou de l'Éducation. Chapter 9. A Curious Tale for Countess Amberglass. 1. At 1:30 the 10th hour of the evening on Duke's Day, as low dark clouds fell in above Camor, blotting out the stars and the moons, Doña Sofia Salvara was being hoisted up into the sky to have a late tea with Doña Angiovesta Vorcenza, Dowager Countess of Amberglass, at the top of the great lady's elderglass tower. The passenger cage rattled and swayed, and Sophia clung to the black iron bars for support. The sweaty hangman's wing fluttered at her hooded coat as she stared south. All of the city lay spread beneath her, black and grey from horizon to horizon, suffused with the glow of fire and alchemy. This was a point of quiet pride for her every time she had the chance to take in this view from one of the five towers. The Eldrin had built glass wonders for men to claim. Engineers had crafted buildings of stone and wood in the Eldrin ruins to make the cities their own. Bonds Magi pretended to the powers the Eldrin must have once held. But it was alchemy that drove back the darkness every evening, alchemy that lit the commonest home and the tallest tower alike, cleaner and safer than natural fire. It was her art that tamed the night. At last her long ascent ended. The cage rattled to a halt beside an embarkation platform 4/5 of the way up Amberglass' full height. The wind sighed mournfully in the strange fluted arches at the peak of the tower. Two footmen in cream-white waistcoats and immaculate white gloves and breeches helped her out of the cage, as they might have assisted her from a carriage down on the ground. Once she was safely on the platform, the two men bowed from the waist.
"Milady Salvara," said the one on the left, "my mistress bids you welcome to Amberglass."
"Most kind," said Doña Sofia. "If it would please you to wait on the terrace, she will join you momentarily."
The same footman led the way past a half-dozen servants in similar livery, who stood panting beside the elaborate arrangement of gears, levers, and chains they worked to haul the cargo cage up and down. They, too, bowed as she passed. She favoured them with a smile and an acknowledging wave. It never hurt to be pleasant to the servants in charge of that particular operation. Doña Vorcenza's terrace was a wide crescent of transparent elderglass jutting out from the north face of her tower, surrounded by brass safety rails. Doña Sofia looked straight down, as she had always been warned not to do, and as she always did. It seemed that she and the footman walked on thin air 40 stories above the stone courtyards and storage buildings at the base of the tower. Alchemical lamps were specks of light, and carriages were black squares smaller than one of her nails. On her left, visible through a series of tall arched windows whose sills were on a level with her waist, were dimly lit apartments and parlours within the tower itself. Doña Vorcenza had very few living relatives, and no children. She was effectively the last of a once powerful clan, and there was little doubt, among the grasping, ambitious nobles of the Alchegrante slopes at least, that Amberglass would pass to some new family upon her death. Most of her tower was dark and quiet, most of its opulence packed away in closets and chests. The old lady still knew how to host a late-night tea, however. At the far northwestern corner of her transparent terrace, with a commanding view of the lightless countryside to the north of the city, a silk awning fluttered in the hangman's wind. Tall alchemical lanterns in cages of gold-gilded brass hung from the four corners of the awning, shedding warm light on the little table and the two high-backed chairs arranged therein. The footman placed a thin black cushion upon the right-hand chair and pulled it out for her. With a swish of skirts, she settled into it and nodded her thanks. The man bowed and strolled away, taking up a watch at a point that was politely out of earshot, but within easy beckoning distance. Sofia did not have long to wait for her hostess. A few minutes after her arrival, old Doña Vorcenza appeared out of a wooden door on the tower's north wall. Age has a way of exaggerating the physical traits of those who live to feel its strains. The round tend to grow rounder, and the slim tend to waste away. Time had narrowed Angiovesta Vorcenza. She was not so much withered as collapsed, a spindly living caricature like a wooden idol animated by the sorcery of sheer willpower. 70 was a fading memory for her, yet she still moved about without an escort on her arm or a cane in her hands. She dressed eccentrically in a black velvet frock coat with fur collars and cuffs. Eschewing the cascading petticoats the ladies of her era had favoured, she actually wore black pantaloons and silver slippers. Her white hair was pulled back and fixed with lacquered pins. Her dark eyes were bright behind her half-moon optics.
"Sofia," she said as she stepped daintily beneath the awning, "what a pleasure it is to have you up here again. It's been months, my dear girl, months. No, do sit. Pulling out my own chair holds no terrors for me. Ah, tell me, how is Lorenzo? And surely we must speak of your garden."
"Lorenzo and I are well, considered solely in ourselves. And the garden thrives, Doña Vorcenza. Thank you for asking."
"Considered solely in yourselves? Then there is something else? Something, dare I pry, external?"
A night tea in Camor was a womanly tradition when one wished to seek the advice of another, or simply make use of a sympathetic ear while expressing regrets or complaints, most frequently concerning men.
"You may pry, Doña Vorcenza, by all means. And yes, yes, external is a very proper term for it."
"But it's not Lorenzo."
"Oh, no. Lorenzo is satisfactory in every possible respect."
Sofia sighed and glanced down at the illusion of empty air beneath her feet and her chair.
"It's both of us that may be in need of advice."
"Advice?
chuckled Doña Vorcenza. "The years play a sort of alchemical trick, transmuting one's mutterings to a state of respectability. Give advice at 40 and you're a nag. Give it at 70 and you're a sage."
"Doña Vorcenza," said Sophia, "you have been of great help to me before. I couldn't think... Well, there was no one else I was comfortable speaking to about this matter, for the time being."
"Indeed. Well, dear girl, I'm eager to be of whatever help I can. But here's our tea. Come, let us indulge ourselves for a few moments."
One of Doña Vorcenza's jacketed attendants wheeled a silver-domed cart toward them and slid it into place beside the little table. When he whisked the dome away, Sophia saw that the cart held a gleaming silver tea service and a subtlety, a perfect culinary replica of amber-glass tower, barely 9 inches high, complete with minuscule specks of alchemical light dotting its turrets. The little glass globes were not much larger than raisins.
"You see how little real work I give to my poor chef," said Doña Vorcenza, cackling. "He suffers in the service of such a plain and simple palate. He takes his revenge with these surprises. I cannot order a soft-boiled egg, but that he finds a dancing chicken to lay it directly on my plate. Tell me, Gilles, is that edifice truly edible?"
"So I am assured, my Lady Vorcenza, save for the tiny lights. The tower itself is spice cake. The turrets and terraces are jellied fruit. The buildings and carriages at the base of the tower are mostly chocolate. The heart of the tower is an apple brandy cream, and the windows..."
"Thank you, Gilles. That will do for an architectural synopsis. But spit out the lights when we're finished, you say?"
"It would be more decorous, milady," said the servant,
a round, delicate-featured man with shoulder-length black ringlets, "to let me remove them for you prior to consumption."
"Decorous? Gilles, you would deny us the fun of spitting them over the side of the terrace like little girls. I'll thank you not to touch them. The tea?"
"Your will, Doña Vorcenza," he said smoothly. "Tea of light."
He lifted a silver teapot and poured a steaming line of pale brownish liquid into a tea-glass. Doña Vorcenza's etched glasses were shaped like large tulip buds with silver bases. As the tea settled into the container, it began to glow faintly, shedding an inviting orange radiance.
"Oh, very pretty," said Doña Sophia. "I've heard of it. Verrari, isn't it?"
"Lasciani."
Doña Vorcenza took the glass from Gilles and cradled it in both hands.
"Quite the latest thing. Their tea masters are mad with a competitive spirit. This time next year we'll have something even stranger to one-up one another with. But forgive me, my dear, I do hope you're not averse to drinking the products of your art as well as working with them in your garden."
"Not at all,"
Sophia replied as the servant set her own glass before her and bowed. She took the cup into her hands and took a deep breath. The tea smelled of mingled vanilla and orange blossoms. When she sipped, the flavors ran warmly on her tongue, and the scented steam rose into her nostrils. Gilles vanished back into the tower itself, while the ladies commenced drinking. For a few moments they enjoyed their tea in appreciative silence, and for a few moments Sophia was almost content.
"Now we shall see,"
said Doña Vorcenza, as she set her half-empty glass down before her,
"if it continues to glow when it comes out the other side."
Doña Salvara giggled despite herself, and the lines on her hostess' lean face drew upward as she smiled.
"Now what did you want to ask me about, my dear?"
"Doña Vorcenza,"
Sophia began, then hesitated.
It is commonly thought that you have some, means to communicate with the Duke's secret constabulary."
"The Duke has a secret constabulary?"
Doña Vorcenza placed a hand against her breast in an expression of polite disbelief.
"The Midnighters, Doña Vorcenza, the Midnighters and their leader..."
"The Duke's spider. Yes, yes. Forgive me, dear girl, I do know of what you speak, but this idea you have, commonly thought, you say? Many things are commonly thought, but perhaps not commonly thought all the way through.
It is very curious, said Sofia Salvara, that when the Doñas come to you with problems, on more than one occasion their problems have reached the ear of the spider, or seemed to, since the Duke's men became involved in assisting with those problems.
Oh, my dear Sofia, when gossip comes to me, I pass it on in packets and parcels. I drop a word or two in the right ear, and the gossip acquires a life of its own. Sooner or later it must reach the notice of someone who will take action.
Doña Vorcenza, said Sofia, I hope I can say without intending or giving offence that you are dissembling.
I hope I can say without disappointing you, dear girl, that you have a very slender basis for making that suggestion.
Doña Vorcenza, Sofia clutched at her edge of the table so hard that several of her finger joints popped. Lorenzo and I are being robbed.
Robbed? Whatever do you mean?
And we have midnighters involved. They've made the most extraordinary claims and made requests of us. But, Doña Vorcenza, there must be some way to confirm that they are what they say they are.
You say midnighters are robbing you?
No, said Sofia, biting her upper lip. No, it's not the midnighters themselves. They are supposedly watching the situation and waiting for a chance to act. But something is just wrong. Or they are not telling us everything they perhaps should.
My dear Sofia, said Doña Vorcenza, my poor troubled girl, you must tell me exactly what has happened and leave out not one detail.
It is difficult, Doña Vorcenza. The situation is rather embarrassing and complicated.
We are all alone up here on my terrace, my dear. You have done all the hard work already in coming over to see me. Now you must tell me everything. Then I'll see to it that this particular bit of gossip speeds on its way to the right ear, I promise you.
Sofia took another small sip of tea, cleared her throat, and hunched down in her seat to look Doña Vorcenza directly in the eyes. "Surely," she began, "you've heard of Astashalin brandy, Doña Vorcenza?"
"More than heard of, my dear. I may even have a few bottles hidden away in my wine cabinets."
"And you know how it is made? The secrets surrounding it?"
"Oh, I believe I understand the essence of the Astashalin mystique. The fussy, black-coated vintners of Emberlane are, shall we say, well served by the stories surrounding their wares."
"Then you can understand, Doña Vorcenza, how Lorenzo and I reacted as we did when the following opportunity supposedly fell into our laps by an act of the gods." 2. The cage containing Doña Salvara creaked and rattled toward the ground, growing ever smaller and fading into the background grey of the courtyard. Doña Vorcenza stood by the brass rails of the embarkation platform, staring into the night for many minutes, while her team of attendants pulled at the machinery of the capstan. Gil wheeled the silver cart with a near-empty pot of tea and the half-eaten amber-glass cake past her, and she turned to him.
"No," she said. "Send the cake up to the solarium. That's where we'll be."
"Who, milady?"
"Reynard."
She was already striding back toward the door to her terrace-side apartments. Her slippered feet made an echoing slap, slap, slap against the walkway.
"Find Reynard. I don't care what he's doing. Find him and send him up to me the moment you've seen to the cake."
Inside the suite of apartments, through a locked door, up a curving stairway, Doña Vorcenza cursed under her breath, her knees, her feet, her ankles.
"Damned venerability," she muttered. "I piss on the gods for the gift of rheumatism."
Her breathing was ragged. She undid the buttons on the front of her fur-trimmed coat as she continued to mount the steps.
At the top, the very peak of the inner tower, there was a heavy oaken door reinforced with iron joints and bands. She pulled forth a key that hung around her right wrist on a silk cord. This she inserted into the silver lockbox above the crystal knob, while carefully pressing a certain decorative brass plate in a wall sconce. A series of clicks echoed within the walls, and the door fell open, inward. Forgetting the brass plate would be a poor idea. She'd specified a rather excessive pull for the concealed crossbow trap when she'd had it installed 3 decades earlier. This was the solarium, then, another 8 stories up from the level of the terrace. The room took up the full diameter of the tower at its apex, 50 feet from edge to edge. The floor was thickly carpeted. A long, curving, brass-railed gallery with stairs at either end spread across the northern half of the space. This gallery held a row of tall witchwood shelves divided into thousands upon thousands of cubbyholes and compartments. The transparent hemispherical ceiling dome revealed the low clouds like a bubbling lake of smoke. Doña Vorcenza tapped alchemical globes to bring them to life as she mounted the stairs to her file gallery. There she worked, engrossed, heedless of the passage of time as her narrow fingers flicked from compartment to compartment. She pulled out some piles of parchment and set them aside, half-considered others and pushed them back in, muttering remembrances and conjecture under her breath. She snapped out of her fugue only when the solarium door clicked open once more. The man who entered was tall and broad-shouldered. He had an angular Vajran face and ice-blonde hair pulled back in a ribbon-bound tail. He wore a ribbed leather doublet over slashed black sleeves, with black breeches and tall black boots. The little silver pins at his collar gave him the rank of captain in the Nightglass Company. The black jackets, the Duke's own, a rapier with straight quillons hung at his right hip.
"Stephen," said Doña Vorcenza without preamble, "have any of your boys or girls paid a recent visit to Don and Doña Salvara on the Isla Durona?"
"The Salvaras? No, certainly not, m'lady."
"You're sure? Absolutely sure?"
Parchments in hand, eyebrows arched, she stalked down the steps, barely keeping her balance.
"I need certain truth from you right now, as badly as I ever have."
"I know the Salvaras, m'lady. I met them both at last year's Day of Changes feast. I rode up to the Sky Garden in the same cage with them."
"And you haven't sent any of the Midnighters to pay them a visit?"
12 gods, no, not one."
"Then someone is abusing our good name, Stephen.